So, okay, so the learning objectives for today's webinar is understanding brain injury. So if you've been to the past webinars that we've had, so this part might be a little repetitive, but it's a good overview, a good reminder of what brain injuries are. And then we're going to analyze the impacts of brain injury and then familiarize ourselves with the return to learn, return to sports protocol for brain injury or pediatric brain injuries. Okay. So today's overview. So, like I mentioned before, the first part, I'm going to do an overview of brain injuries, the changes after a brain injury. Then we'll talk about the vulnerability of a brain injury or about the vulnerability of a developing brain. And then we'll go into the return to learn, return to sports or play protocol, and then some resources. So the overview. What is a brain injury? So the definition that I have on the brain is the definition of a brain injury or an acquired brain injury, and that's an injury that's not hereditary, congenital, or caused by birth. So in other words, it's a brain injury that you that occurs after birth or you acquire after birth, and it's the change in the function of the brain. So I do have a poll question for you. Let me see if I can pull that up. And okay, so the poll question is, which brain injury type is caused by external forces such as an accident? Okay, I'll give a couple of more seconds for you guys to answer this question. Okay, 15 more seconds. I don't know if other people want to answer this question. Okay, I'll close it. And here are the results. So if you said traumatic brain injury, you are correct. All right, let me go on to those definitions. So, the definition that I shared with you, acquired brain injury or brain injury, goes into these two categories of non-traumatic brain injury and traumatic brain injury. So, a non-traumatic brain injury is also often referred to as an acquired brain injury, and that's an insult to the brain that occurs after birth, but by internal factors. So, those are stroke, aneurysm, tumors. And then we have traumatic brain injury, which is an assault to the brain that's caused by external forces such as fall, car crashes, sports injuries, and assaults. So, a traumatic brain injury can be further diagnosed or categorized into mild, moderate, and severe. In our Brain Injury 101, we go a little bit more in depth about this, but I just have some two criterias that people kind of look at when trying to de determine the severity of the traumatic brain injury. So we have mild, moderate, and severe. And we some criteria that are looked into or trying to help determine the severity are loss of consciousness and post-traumatic amnesia. And I want to point out under mild, they have loss of consciousness 30 minutes or less. And I want to say, like, with a mild traumatic brain injury, someone doesn't necessarily need to lose consciousness to be diagnosed with a mild traumatic brain injury. And then with that post-traumatic amnesia, this is when someone kind of appears to be in a fog, and it's not amnesia, is that they can't remember who they are, but it's amnesia in the sense that they are unable to lay down new information. So if you're asking them information, if you want to do like a memory test and asking them information that requires their long-term memory, such as their name, where they live, phone numbers. Well, I don't know if anyone remembers phone numbers now, but things that require them to use their long-term memory, that's not accurate memory test. You want to give them new information, something that requires them to use their short-term memory, and then ask them a few minutes later to for them to recall that information that you gave them. And if they're unable to provide you that information, there that could be a sign that this individual or child has sustained a mild traumatic brain injury. So, for those who do not know, a concussion is a type of a traumatic brain injury, and it's the most common traumatic brain injury. It says that 3 out of 4 of traumatic brain injuries are happen every year are concussions. So if you don't know what a concussion is, again, it's a traumatic brain injury, and it's ca usually caused by a bump, blow, or jolt to the head, causing the head and the brain to move rapidly in the skull back and forth. So, I did find a video that I think would give you a little bit more information, kind of explain it a little bit better. All right, so let me see. I'm gonna exit out of here. I have it all queued up. Let me make it big for you guys. Hopefully, you guys are still seeing this. And let me put
A concussion is a change in how the brain functions. So it's not a structural injury, it's a functional injury. And so when the body or the head is struck, the brain will slosh around inside the head and it changes how the brain works.
concussions in youth sports is important because you're talking about a potential threat to the development of that youngster's brain. Anything that potentially affects that in a negative way has to be fully reckoned with and dealt with.
It used to be felt that you needed to have loss of consciousness in order to be considered a concussion, but in sport-related concussion, loss of consciousness only occurs maybe 10% of the time.
Sometimes it might just be like an elbow to the head, or just a tap, or somebody coming down from a rebound and hitting you on the back, or something like that, and you get a concussion.
You can get them also without any contact to the head. You can get, concussion from a whiplash, a car accident, whatever it is. It happens.
Okay, let me stop this.
If you're a college student,
presentation. Okay, hopefully you guys were able to watch that video and get a little bit more information about concussions. Okay.
Naja, you have a question in the Q&A.
Okay. So is that also more so for not remembering the event? I will say, said in previous webinars, that not all brain injuries are the same. So maybe one individual may have a hard time even remembering events leading up to the event, maybe even including the event, and then things or events that are happening after. I hope that makes sense. So they may not be able to remember things that were leading up to the event that caused the concussion or the brain injury, or things that happen right after the event. So in those cases, it could also include the event as well. Oh, okay. All right, let me see if I can pull up a poll question. Thank you again, Nawada, my coworker, letting me know. So I have another poll question up for you. What is the most common brain injury in early life? You have the option between falls, sports injuries, and motor vehicle accidents. So you go ahead and you can It's your guess. Again, thank you for participating in my polls. For the people who are, I really like it. I'm giving you 5 more seconds if you want to put your question in or your answer in. Thank you. All right, I'm ending it, sharing it. Hopefully you can see that about 60% of 67% of y'all picked false. So let's see what we have for the answer. So the correct answer, over half of traumatic brain injuries in children are false, about 55%. Then after that is unintentional blows to the head, that's 24%. So that could be like a soccer ball hitting the child's head. So some possible risk factors that could cause a brain injury or traumatic brain injury. We have age. I do mention older adults in age, but younger children are more prone to falls. And that could also be tied into that socioeconomic status, whether that they're unable to have safety guards or have unsafe play areas, or it could also be also another factor for age is adolescence with car accidents, unintentional car accidents, and then also during those teen years, it's most likely for teenagers to participate in impact sports. And over the past few years, the incidents for TBI that are happening in these impact sports have doubled for athletes from the age of 19. Under the age of 19 years of age. So on this screen, I'm showing you some statistics or some stats. Based off of the 2016 parental report, 8.3% of girls and 5.6% of boys between the age of 3 and 17 have reported to have a head injury in their lifetime. And then as the age of children increased, they saw there was an increase in head injuries, peaking at 11.7% that had head injury in them. So with a brain injury, head injury, depending on where you are, let's talk about some possible changes. So this is changes that are across the board, no matter what age. You'll have some physical changes, specifically from a brain injury, that can include motor skills such as muscle control, balance, your fine motor skills. And those are a lot of things that children are using and trying to improve on while they are at school, so we'll talk a little bit more about that. Then there are also some cognitive changes, so memory problems, as I mentioned, difficulty paying attention, concentrating, impaired problem solving skills, and then with the emotional and behavioral changes, there could be some impulse control, increase in aggression, and then there's mood swings, and then there's emotional liability, which is, to me, best way I could explain it is with emotional liability, it's just a more extreme mood swing in the fact of the emotions that the person is exhibiting or showing, and then how fast they change. So with someone crying 1 minute and then literally a few seconds later they're laughing, so that's an example of emotional liability. So depending on how old the child is, they may have a hard time reporting how they're feeling after a brain injury. So again, due to a parent parental report, some parents reported that their child appeared to be dazed or stunned after the event. They were having, like I mentioned earlier, they couldn't recall events prior to the event, and then having trouble recalling events after the hit or the bump or the fall that caused the brain injury or the concussion. They're having trouble answering questions, or they're answering questions very slowly. And then forgetting class schedule, assignments, so also leading into their trouble in school. So there was an observation that 77% to 88% of youth reported school problems as a result of a concussion and symptoms diminishing after an academic, in their academic skills. All right, so I'll also later in a few slides after this, I will talk about some signs and symptoms that health school professionals can look into. But first, let's go into the vulnerability of a developing brain. So I do have another poll question for you. Let me see if I can queue that up for you. Okay, launch. True or false? A brain development is most rapid during early life. True or false? More participation, I like it. All right. So I will end this poll. Let me share the result. And it's 50-50. All right. So let's see what the answer is. Okay, I have a video that can help us give us the answer. All right.
By the time a human embryo is 5 weeks old, it is just the size of an apple seed, but the brain has already begun to grow. By 8 weeks, the basic structure of the brain and central nervous system are in place. The neural networks are spreading out, and even now the nerve signals are traveling more than 150 miles an hour. At birth, nearly all 100 billion neurons of the human brain are already in place, but the brain only weighs about 25% of what it will later on. It's about to embark on its fastest growing period, quadrupling in size by the time a child finishes preschool. By age six, the brain is 90% of its adult size. During that burst of growth, 700 new neural connections are formed every second as we gain the capacity to smile around 2 months, to talk usually around a year, and to dress ourselves around the age of three. In those early years, in fact, throughout our lives, the brain changes through experience, learning to speak, taking those first steps, understanding colors and shapes, forming novel thoughts. But as certain neurons are used more frequently, other unused neurons go away. It's a process called pruning. And almost anything can shape us in those baby and toddler years. First words, first ice cream, first TV show, first argument, for better or worse.
Hopefully you're able to see my screen.
That is one of the most important questions in this world right now. Are you living the life you want, or are you living the life you've been programmed and answered?
Sorry about that. So just to summarize what the video explained to us, that there is a rapid neural growth in the first few years of life. The brain experience rapid neural growth, and with the astonishing number of neurons or nerve cells. And with that, there's synapse formation, and synapses are connection between those neurons or nerve cells. And that's how information is to get sent throughout the brain. And during early life, there are excessive amount of synapse formation and creating a neural network with an intricate and elaborate, and elaborate than most adult brains. And then neuroplasticity, a term, I'm not sure if you have heard of this term before, but neuroplasticity is the ability for the brain to reorganize and structure itself based off of experience, learning, environmental influence. And this is very heightened during the early, during early life. And also during early life, there's very sensitive periods very specific periods in early life, as mentioned in the video. You know, you're learning to talk, smile, dress yourself. So those are some of those examples of sensitive periods, and where we're more receptive, for example, to language. And then that helps shape through those sensitive periods, those experiences through life, those all help shape us. So the experience interaction that happened in early life play a significant role in our cognitive abilities, regulating our emotions, social skills, and just having a very positive and enriching environment can also help with that neural connection and overall brain function. However, if the child is neglect or experience trauma, such as a brain injury, this could have a negative impact on the brain and then could potentially have a negative impact on their cognitive, emotional, and behavioral, and leading to them to have some challenges in those areas. Another poll question. I'm almost surprised when they pop up. Okay. Okay, poll question. What's the critical factor to reducing risk of brain injury in early life? We have education and awareness, luck, or age. Okay. I don't know if a few other people want to answer this question. I'll leave it up for another 2 seconds. Okay, I'm gonna end it. Share results. So if you picked education and awareness, you picked correct. Good job. Okay, let me stop sharing. All right. Some things that we can educate or aware our school professionals and what to look out for if they suspect or if they have a child that did sustain a brain injury in the classroom. There's probably an increase in problem paying attention, concentration, increase in problem remembering or learning new information. Like I said, that post-traumatic amnesia, so you're having trouble laying down new information, longer time needing to complete tasks or assignments, difficulty organizing or shifting between tasks, and maybe with all of these changes, it might lead to inappropriate or impulsive behavior during class, increase in irritability. They might be fatigued, stressed, because they're unable to cope. So there's lots of things that can happen after a brain injury. that we should let our school professionals know. And with that being said, what can be done in the classroom and or helping, in the classroom? So we have the return to learn or return to play or return to sports, depending on where you're reading your articles, protocols. So both of these protocols are helping the child. It's a protocol, a program to follow to help the child to return back or try to get the child to return back to their learning activities before injury, and the same for the sports. So let's go through the steps. Before we get into the steps of the protocol, you might be wondering, how soon can you put this protocol in place? Usually it's 24 to 48 hours after the injury. However, if a child does sustain a brain injury or a concussion, you want to try to seek medical professional assistance. So if your healthcare professional says a little bit longer than the 48 hours, then you want to listen to their guidelines. But usually this guideline is 24 to 48 hours after the injury. And during that 24 to 48 hours, the child should be resting, not necessarily in like a dark room or anything, but you want to kind of limit that screen time. If they're into books, anything that would really require them to do any of that cognitive functions, or even like their physical motion, so like those fine motor skills, so writing, puzzles, so anything that might use those types of skills, you want to take a break during those 24 to 48 hours. Okay, on to the protocol. So with the return to learn protocol, the first step, you want to start resuming your activity of daily activities, whether that is those activities that I mentioned, reading, writing, puzzles. You want to start doing those activities, but you want to start in small increments, so maybe 5 to 15 minutes, and then you want to gradually increase. And you want to increase in a way that the child is able to tolerate and it doesn't worsen any symptoms. So, and that will be a very key thing throughout both the return to learn and the return to play or return to sports protocol. You want to increase it gradually, and you don't want to increase it without that would limit the worsening of the symptoms. I hope that makes sense. So step two is you want to start incorporating some of those school activities. So is that the homework, reading, and other cognitive activities? But you want to make sure you do this outside of the classroom. And I think for that is, you know, if you do it outside of the classroom, you're able to control the environment. So there could be some light sensitivity, some noise sensitivity that the child might be experienced after the concussion. And so if you're doing it outside of the classroom, you're able to control some of those sensitivities. But the ultimate goal of the return to learn protocol is to get the child back to school. So after step two, if you're able to increase those activities without them increasing or worsening any of the symptoms that happen after a brain injury, you want to start to return the child to school part-time, again, introducing that class into that classroom setting. And so you want to slowly increase that, see if they're able to tolerate it, and gradually work up to a full day of school. So during step three and four, that introducing the child back into that classroom setting, here are some things that you can do to help with that, some adjustments that can be put in place to help the child during this transition. So there's some environmental changes. Again, you can, some other things that I didn't mention, like frequent rest breaks, limiting the screening time on electronic devices. Again, that sensitivity, that light sensitivity, curriculum adjustments, so extra time to complete tasks, or maybe even providing pre-printed class notes, and then test adjustments, so delaying tests and quizzes, and then permitting additional time to complete those tests. And then there's some physical adjustments. I feel like also really apply to the return to sports protocol. But, you know, with school, there's probably recess. It's been a while since I've been in school, so I'm hoping they have recess. But you want to avoid any activities that has risk of contact, since the brain is still trying to recover from that brain injury. So let's talk about that return to sports protocol. So step one, you wanna gradually introduce work, school. So with that being said, the return to learn and the return to sports protocol can be done at the same time. You don't have to do one and then do the other. They can be done at the same time. Again, you want to personalize these protocol. Do it as the child is able to tolerate. In step two, you want to start increasing the heart rate. So this could be light aerobics, like a stationary bike or walking at like a medium pace. And you want to try, If they're more into sports, I'm guessing they have a little bit more assessment and they'll be able to know when they're able to get their heart rate up. And that would, you want to make sure the first step, you want to get it about 50% of max heart rate. And then gradually, if they're able to tolerate that without any worsening of their symptoms, you want to move it up to 70%. Okay, and then you want to, in step three, you want to add movement. So this one, before you move on to this step, you want to make sure you get medical clearance that involve any head impact sports. But with this specific goal, you want to add the movement. So this may be me be doing some drills, maybe start to put some activities that do involve a change in direction of the head or the body. And it could be very individual drills. They don't have to be the drills with the team. So in step four, resume usual intensity of exercise. Coordination, increased thinking. So this would be more of those drills that would be with the team or multiplayer training. And again, the goal of this is to help increase the exercise intensity and coordination, increased thinking. With step five, the child is able to participate in normal training activity with the goal of restoring the confidence and functional skills under a supervised coaching staff. And then with step six, the child should be able to return to a normal game and sports activities. However, if a child goes through both the return to learn or the return to sports, and they're still exhibiting some challenges after 4 weeks, I kind of got ahead of myself, so let me actually put this poll up first. All right, so which type of support can schools offer to students with brain injury? We have the individualized education plan, also known as IEPs, physical therapy, or family vacation. Okay. All right. I'm going to end the poll. I think I got everyone to do that one. And you guys picked right, so good job. Kudos to you. All right. So, like I was mentioning before, if a child goes through the return to learn protocol, or they're trying to get through the return to learn protocol, or the return to sports protocol, and they're still having some challenges after or completing that protocol, then these further supports should be considered. So the return to learn protocol and the return to sports protocol, those are just almost like guidelines to help teachers and coaches with placing in these adjustments. And they, again, should only last about 4 weeks if they are still there, or still these be changes in their behavior, emotion, cognition, then these further support should be in place. So the response to intervention was put into place in 2014, specific for learning disabilities, and it's to measure the response to scientific research-based instruction. And this is, again, to help support both student and teacher. And then we have the 505. Take a breath. The 504 plan, and these are for accommodations, different to adjustments, accommodations to the general education for the students, so they can access the curriculum. And then we have the individualized education plan, or the IEP, that's specialized program of instructions to students who have been identified or who would need this support. So what's out there that could help, especially for teachers, parents who might need help with finding the right adjustment or for their student? There is the TAC, which stands for Teacher Acute Concussion Tool. And this tool is to help build that knowledge and confidence in teachers to help them learn to adjust their teaching style for students who have sustained a concussion. But it's not only for teachers, It's not only tailored towards students that have sustained a concussion. It could also be from trauma and also COVID. So the same tool could be used for students who have sustained any trauma or COVID. And then REAP. This was developed in 2019 and then translated to Spanish in 2013. And this stands for Reduce, Remove, Educate, Accommodate, /Adjust, Pace, Protocol. Again, it's a multidisciplinary approach to the return to learn and return to play protocol to help support students and family, healthcare providers, and school. But there's a caveat, sorry. These aren't available in Maryland. However, if there is enough interest, I'm in the process of trying to see if we can get Maryland signed up for these tools, these resources to provide to schools and school professionals, so they are able to have these resources. So just, send us an email, let us know. And then, have another question for you guys. Is it going to, okay. Okay, have you ever heard any local organizations that could provide support for individuals with brain injury, yes or no? Okay, I'm going to end the poll. I think everyone answered. If you said yes, I'm so glad you listened. Yes. Okay, let me stop. Hopefully that stops sharing. So yes, there are resources available for individuals who have sustained a brain injury. If you do not know the Brain Injury Association of Maryland, we are a resource for individuals who have sustained a brain injury. We help with finding local resources. We can help with referrals such as to Kennedy Krieger. They do have a lot of programs in their system that do help individuals, specifically children who have sustained a brain injury. There's also, if you need other resources that may be adjacent, that maybe have been caused by the brain injury, Maryland 211 is another resource. Also, if you just want to learn more about brain injury, the Model System Knowledge of Translation Center has a really great library of resources. They even have comic strips or comic books for children, really anyone. So you can learn a little bit more about brain injury, even concussions. There's the Ohio Valley Center of Brain Injury Prevention and Rehabilitation. And BrainLine, those are also other websites that have really good literature where you can read more about brain injury. And that is the conclusion of today's webinar. I do want to say thank you for your time and participation in this webinar. I don't know if there's any more questions. But let me stop my screen and let's see if there's any questions. If it's easy for you to talk, maybe I can allow you to talk if you want to. Okay, if not, you can always email me or our organization. Our organization's email is info@biamd.org. Or if you want to email me directly, it's my last name, BRITTON@biamd.org. Well, thank you, Marotta. And then hopefully once we end this webinar, it will lead you to a post evaluation of today's webinar. Once you fill that out, if you want a certificate of education or certificate of attendance, just let me know on that evaluation sheet and I will send that over to you in a couple of days. But if not, if there's no questions, I think we can end today's webinar. Again, thank you for your time and participation.